Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today's show focuses on the stories of two turn-of-the-century houses and the people who lived in these houses. Later in the hour, author David Alley tells a story of The Good Serpent Orphanage, a historically accurate novel about the Good Servant Orphanage in Vallejo, California. He writes historical fiction based on haunted locations. Retired economics professor Mark Morlock was born in Iowa and has written a debut novel which is set in a Midwestern city. It explores the complex story of an old house and the people connected to it. The Secret of Summit Avenue is a history of everyday life charted across several generations. The Secret Watcher of Summit Avenue is a history of everyday life charted across several generations. Mark Morlock, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Are you a cartoonist?
No, I'm not.
You know why I asked that question? Because there are cartoons in your book.
There are cartoons in the book, right.
And the only signature is a fictional character signing these cartoons.
That's right.
I thought maybe you drew those cartoons.
Well, I didn't. I wish I could. I came up with the idea of having one of the characters being a cartoonist. And so I wanted to have his cartoons. It's a he. And I wanted to have his cartoons in the book. And my wife and I came up with some ideas for cartoons that we thought were really funny. And so what I did is I went to Chico State. I went to the art department and asked someone I knew there from my days at the university if there was anybody that would like to earn a little extra money by drawing some cartoons for me. And I was linked up with a man named Mike Swan, who has since graduated and gone off into the somewhere. So we made an arrangement, and I paid for them and got the rights to them and all that kind of thing. But he did all the cartoons. There's three cartoons in the book, and I think Mike has drawn seven different ones for me. So they're not, I have some of them just on the walls at home and things like that.
So in your book, you have these three cartoons signed by C. Estrada, mm-hmm. who is your fictional character, Carlos Estrada.
Carlos, right.
And you have the fictional character sign these. So I thought maybe Carlos Estrada was your alter ego, Mark.
Well, in some ways, I'd really like to be Carlos.
So in a way, he is your alter ego.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, one illustration is on the cover of your book, and you do credit the person who drew that. And I was surprised because I know Cindy Medeiros,
who doesn't?
I did not know. Yeah, she's a wonderful caterer. But I did not know that she was an artist.
Right. The picture on the book is a result of a series of remarkable coincidences in which a friend of mine, Sandy Shepard, was at our house, and we were talking about what we're going to do with the cover, and I told her that I had something I wanted to use, and she looked at it, and then she says, you know, I have friend who has this picture of a house on her wall, and that's a woman named Karen Weaver, who I also know quite well, and it might just work. And so I said he took some pictures of the portrait,
the illustration,
and we looked at them. It was, of course, absolutely wonderful, and it turned out that Cindy had been the artist. Back in the early 60s, I think, when Cindy was an undergrad at Chico State, and she was an art major, and so she had painted it, and somehow it had gotten into the hands of Karen Weaver. And so I asked Cindy if I could use it, and she said, she was happily, yes.
You might mention that Sandy Shepard is an author herself.
Yes, she
is. A very popular book. So
right.
She was a good one to consult if you are working on this novel, a fellow author.
That's right.
But I wondered when I saw the photograph if you perhaps commissioned it, said, here's, you know, talking to Cindy and said, Cindy, here's what I have in mind. But no, it was the other way around. Cindy had drawn this illustration of a house many years ago.
Years ago.
And you thought, yeah, that's it. That's the house I'm talking about, writing about.
And the house is in Chico, somewhere over 2nd and 3rd Street, over by, she couldn't remember which one was so long ago. And I have yet to go in search of it, but I'm going to do that.
So this book is really a Chico creation because you live in Chico. The artist who did the cover lives in Chico. And you had advice and suggestions. You had a cartoonist who was from Chico.
Mm-hmm.
Might remind people that my guest is Mark Morlock. And this is his debut novel that we're going to be talking about, The Secret Watcher of Summit Avenue. And so on the cover of the book is this house. And it's not typical for a house to be a central character, but would you say that that's kind of the case?
Absolutely. Right.
This house is the central character that ties it all together.
It is. That's really true. Everything, not everything, but most of the things that are important in this book, meaningful in the book, happen in that house, right?
So we have where the house is located on Summit Avenue, and you say that the house in the illustration is located in Chico, but that's not where the story takes place.
No.
This fictional house is where, Mark?
Yeah, the fictional house is in an unnamed Midwestern city. I can say a little more about the house. The floor plan for the house, and the house is important, and the floor plan for the house where the rooms are variously located and things, become something that you really need to understand, I think, when you read the book. And it's easy to understand. But I really designed the book after my grandmother's house in Iowa, in a little town called Clarence, Iowa, which was built for her in 1898.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a poor person's Victoria, I would call it, you know, with lots of carpenter's lace and beautiful long porch and a lovely, lovely house. So the floor, and I knew that floor plan, like the back of my hand, because of all the time I spent with my wonderful grandmother there.
Well, I suspected this fictional house was based on an actual house, and then I wondered, since you were born in Iowa, if you lived to adulthood there or if you left Iowa before you had a chance to really get to know Iowa.
Yeah, my connection with Iowa is tenuous. I was born there. My dad was in the military, and so we moved all over the place. And I just happened to be in Iowa when I was born. I think, in fact, the family was living with my grandmother at that time. So I moved around with my father, and my family moved around with the various Air Force bases that he was stationed at. I did spend one full year there, my year in fourth grade I spent there. And believe it or not, I still, up through probably high school, I still had friends in that little town that every time I'd go and visit, we'd get back together.
Well, you know what I enjoyed, a lot of things about this house, this main character that I'm calling it, was that it brought back memories that I had forgotten. Not too far from the house I grew up in, there was this really old house. I wish now I had explored more its history, because it had the claw-footed tub in the bathroom, and the light switches were not flipping up and down. There were two buttons,
mm-hmm.
and you push the button into the wall
mm-hmm.
to turn it on or off.
Mm-hmm.
And these are little details I'd forgotten about until I was reading your description of this house.
Right. I had to do a lot of research. One of the really fun things about writing this book for me, in another life I'll be an architect because I love especially old houses. But I had to do a lot of research because I wanted it to be authentic. And so the questions arose, would they have hot and cold running water? Would they have central heating? And the answers to those were yes, they would. Given that they were in a relatively large city, they would have had it by then. Little questions like, what would the foundation have been made of? Would it have been cement? No. Cement was has been around for thousands of years, but it wasn't the foundation for houses until, let's say, well into the 20th century. So it was a stone. It would have been stone or brick, and so I had to research all those things to make it as accurate as I could.
Well, and that's what I enjoyed, because I could see that you had done a lot of research, and that makes it real for us, the reader, mm-hmm. brings it to life. There's not something that pulled you out of it because you say, nah, that's an anachronism there. Mark had that wrong. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing to pull you out of the story because it was all so authentic and right. accurate about this house.
Another example of that was the draft, the World War II draft that plays a significant role. In the book. So I had to research that. How exactly did it work? It was a lottery. It was, in fact, a lottery, yeah.
So your field when you were an academic was economics.
That's right.
But it sounds like your interests are wide-ranging.
Yes, I think so.
History and architecture. And you mentioned that you researched the history of the war and the draft.
Right.
Because you follow four generations.
That's right.
That lived in this house. So what I'd like you to do is start the very first page of your book is labeled epistle.
A letter.
A letter. And we can distinguish the letters, the epistles, in your book because you have it in a different script. You have it in italics.
That's right.
That when this voice, it's the narrator really. That's in my head. I was labeling this person the narrator.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
And I didn't want to say he or she just now because we don't know.
You do not know.
When the narrator starts out, we don't know, well, who is this person?
That's
is
right.
it a man or a woman? Is so?
It's a secret.
It is a secret. And that's one of the mysteries as we're reading along. Who is this voice that's narrating the story? Because the epistle is in the first person. And then we turn the page and chapter one is third person.
Third person, that's right.
So read us that very first epistle, Mark, if you would.
All right. If old houses would only talk, what stories they could tell of all that's gone on inside their closed doors and sometimes shaded windows. Often enough, I suppose, these stories would be what most people would call unexceptional, of day-to-day life interspersed with the commonplace periods of joy and disappointment, of comfort and heartache that are the human's lot. But that old Winkler house across the street, the stories that house could tell would take a long time in the telling. Now, at the beginning of the new century, it's over 100 years old. Built in the Victorian style that was popular at the time, it sits on the top of a long rise overlooking the city below and has housed, on and off, four generations of Winklers. And though you would never know it, it has over those long years witnessed many times over seasons of great joy and terrible grief, and has weathered through periods of madness and delusion, of deceit bordering on treachery, and of well-disguised crime. And it remembers all these stories. Oh, I'm sure of that. Oh, yes, it remembers. We first met, that house and I, in the years just before World War II, when I was young, and it was already middle-aged. I was attracted to it and the people in it right from the start. From my bedroom window across the street, I could look down the block and see its tall roof line and part of that long porch. That would be a comfort for me later, after the war started and things turned bad for everybody. Well, almost everybody. We were happy back then, at first anyway. I was in love, and so I think was that house. The long, low, welcoming porch shone with a warm blush. And especially, it seemed to me, when Henry Winkler was sitting there in his old wicker rocker, puffing on his pipe. Back then, I swear that its long, high porch literally smiled out at the world, its corners pointing up, its picket railing offering a toothy, contented grin. Yes, that old house loved Henry Winkler, as in the years to come would I. But our story doesn't start here. It starts years earlier in 1894 on a warm Sunday in midsummer when Wilhelm Winkler, Henry's father, had a secret to reveal.
This is author Mark Morlock reading from his debut novel, The Secret Watcher of Summit Avenue. And it sounds like this secret watcher is the one writing this letter at the very first page. Is this person the secret watcher, would you say?
I don't know whether I want to reveal that.
Okay.
I think that the idea of the secret watcher, by the way, I kind of stole that from Joseph Conrad's title, but I hope I don't get sued by him. The narrator that I just read is, in a sense, detached from the story at this point. It is detached from the story, but obviously at some point this person was very attached to the story. So I guess in that sense what you say is correct, yeah.
But that's all we know at this point.
That's right.
And now, Mark, you named this character Henry Winkler.
Right.
What possessed you to use the same name as a famous TV character, actor?
I know. And to tell you the honest truth, it never once occurred to me that I was doing that.
I did wonder if that was just by accident, purely by accident.
Purely by accident. There was someone in the Army I knew whose last name was Winkler. And the name always kind of fascinated me. It's a kind of a Winkle, as a name, it seems to me it's a strange name. It's a German name, as I discovered. And I'm a German. I'm a third generation German.
I noticed some of the German references in your book, and I thought that was the case for you, that you had German ancestry.
Right.
So you named this character Henry Winkler, right. And he was one of the characters who inhabit this house and your book.
Right.
And purely by accident, that he happens to be an actor, rather well-known actor by the name of Henry Winkler. And you just said that this is not the narrator is more modern day than when your story begins. When the house, you have in chapter one, the next page in your book, in 1894, America was reveling in a newfound industrial affluence. It was a time of growth and marvelous change. And this is what we see as we follow the story of this house. We see how America changes as a nation. And it's only within the space of 100 years that this house, you say it was built in 1894, and your grandmother's house, you said, was built in 1898?
Yes.
So this house is, when you're writing this, you have in mind your grandmother's house.
Well, very much so.
And you take us through a tour of the house, and I enjoyed that tour of the house. I'm sure you enjoyed writing it. So would you read us a little bit of this opening chapter?
Mm-hmm.
This is on page 6.
It starts from where?
From the start.
All right. In 1864, America was reveling in a newfound industrial affluence.
Excuse me. You said 64. 1894.
In 1894, America was reveling in a newfound industrial affluence. It was a time of growth and marvelous change, of forward-looking optimism. In the cities of the nation, steel was replacing wood. Underground waterworks were providing running water at the turn of a tap. Electricity was lighting homes and buildings into propelling trolleys. And rutted, dusty streets were giving way to wide avenues of cobblestone and smooth brick. Summit Avenue, in the newest part of a city in the heart of America, was one of these new streets. Situated on the extreme north of the expanding city and removed from the noisy industry of the south, it ran along the crest of a hill for 6 blocks between Centennial Drive and Market.
I just wondered, too, as you're reading that, are any of these streets existed in your hometown or the town where you were born, or these are made up?
My mother lived for a number of years after she retired in Iowa City, and so I came to know Iowa City very well. And she lived on Summit Avenue.
Uh-huh. So the title is
in fact, the
meaningful for you.
The address is the same address, 228. Yeah. It's 228 or 227, I think.
And then you say that immigrants and sons of immigrants were rapidly filling the High Avenue with large and beautiful homes. And reading your book, Mark, there's one street in particular in my hometown where I grew up were these huge, beautiful homes. And I always, when I'd walk or ride my bike down and wonder the story behind these houses. Mm-hmm. And so I can see how you were curious about this and wanted to write the story of these books. You say there were stately Gothic revivals with steeply pitched roofs. So here you go into detail about the style and the colored tile patterns on their mansard roofs. Now, on this particular, why don't you pick up there? On this particular Midsummer Sunday,
okay.
And they go to service at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. So
that's
if you
right.
have German
they're good,
ancestry,
they're good
you're
Germans,
probably,
but...
yes, I was just going to say that, probably you went to Lutheran Church.
My grandmother was an offshoot of the Lutheran Church, it's German. So this is on page 6.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On this particular Midsummer Sunday, the morning service at St. Paul's Lutheran Church was finally over, and after the obligatory punch and light conversation, Wilhelm Winkler had loaded his wife Sophie and 7-year-old daughter Ellen into the old delivery wagon and turned the wagon north to begin the long, slow climb up Centennial Drive. Wilhelm had a secret, and they were on their way to a surprise. He was a small man, short, 5'8" in his Sunday shoes, and wiry, with dark straight hair and deep brown eyes that sparkled with energy and humor, and a thin mustache that turned up at the ends. He was a first-generation American, coming to this country with his widowed father when he was 2.
Mark, when I hear you read this description of this character, the patriarch, the founding father of this family, I wondered if you're describing maybe one of your own ancestors?
I had on my mind very, very much the history of my own family on my mother's side. My grandmother, whose married name was Reinking, and whose name was Hazemeyer, good German names, all of them, had in fact emigrated when she was 13 years old with her older sister, the two of them alone, in I think it was 1888 that she came to the United States. So I'm very, you know, I have a very, very deep sense of indebtedness to the immigrant experience. I consider myself, you know, third generation, and that's not really very many.
No, it isn't. My guest is Mark Morlock, and he has written a novel, The Secret Watcher of Summit Avenue. And its central character, really, is this house that is just, we're introduced to the first owner, we assume, of this house. And his occupation also, I thought, was a very German occupation.
Sausage maker.
And I wondered, was that the case? Maybe you had one old family member who was in that occupation?
I just really like sausage.
Okay. So he takes his wife and his young daughter on a tour of this house after church. And what are the features of this house that are so impressive?
Well, the house was state-of-the-art at the time and would have been amazing for people that had never had these things. The house had electricity, and the house had running water. It had plumbing. It had a water heater and a house heater. A lot of us could remember the old radiators and the coal-fired heaters. And so those things would have been very, very new for the Winklers.
Well, now, did your grandmother's house have any of these features?
Oh, they had all of them, yeah. I'm not sure when they all came, because when I came around, which was...
Everybody had running water.
That's right.
And electricity.
That's right. So I don't know whether her house, because she also had a well by the side of the house, a cistern was common. And so I'm not sure when Clarence, Iowa, established there. It was a small town, so it's unlikely that at this time they would have had it right away. They would have relied on cisterns.
Well, I think other readers besides myself in reading your book will go back to thinking about their grandmother or great-grandmother or grandfather's house. And I found myself going through my grandmother's house as I was reading your book mm-hmm. about this house with all these wonderful features. Mm-hmm. And then when you're describing this book, when you're telling this story, I was thinking, okay, Mark was a teacher, and I wondered if, in addition to entertaining us with these lovely descriptions, if there was something you wanted us to learn through this story.
Well, I think that the main thing that I want people to take away from the book is not that it's what happens in the emotional lives of the characters. I write only about human emotion. That's the only thing that I write about. It's the only thing that I think is worth writing about, and certainly the only thing that I'm capable of writing about is human emotion. So this book is really filled with human emotion coming from all over the place. But I did want it to be accurate, and the whole 20th century is so fascinating. I think for most people find it fascinating because to our minds, so much has changed over the course of the century. My mother, who was born in 1910, she remembered having an outhouse. And so that generation went from dirt roads to highways, automobiles.
Just in that one generation.
Jet planes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And your descriptions are so so well done that you actually got a star from Kirkus Review.
I did.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you about this book, Mark. I might remind listeners that the title of the book is The Secret Watcher of Summit Avenue. The author is Mark Morlock. And after a short break, I'll be asking local author David Alley about the story of a very different residence. His latest book is a historical novel about an orphanage in Vallejo, the Good Serpent Orphanage. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. On the cover of my next guest's book is also an illustration of an old Victorian house. Novelist David Alley is originally from Northern California, but as an ordained member of the clergy, he spent 7 years as a church pastor and served parishes in Brazil, Idaho, and Hawaii. He then served in various management and executive positions with public and community-based organizations and was the executive director for a Central Valley Chamber of Commerce. He has also served as a professional consultant to both the state of California and the private sector. He eventually returned to Northern California and for the past 14 years has served the county of Glenn, working for a social services agency. David Alley has 3 degrees, one in theological studies, one in business administration, and a master's degree in public administration. He is author of 2 previous books of historical fiction, Wind in the Past, which is the true story behind the haunting of Pacheco Pass, and Lava, a historical novel of haunted Hawaii. His third historical novel is based on haunted locations, and this is The Good Serpent Orphanage, about the infamous Good Servant Orphanage in Vallejo, California. David Alley, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be back with you. Appreciate you having me again and the opportunity to share with you and your listening audience.
Well, I wanted people to know your background as a professional person in positions of responsibility, somebody who has both feet on the ground, because you write books about haunted places.
I do.
And I was wondering if you catch flack from your colleagues.
You know, it's one of those strange dichotomies. I think we all have that scientific part of ourselves that expresses itself when we choose a career or a pathway, go to work, hold our job, do what we're required to do. Nevertheless, in my unique situations, there's been a number of occasions where I have come across and or witnessed things that were not explainable by science. And I found myself typically just burying those, not wanting to talk about them or not willing to share them. But as the years have gone by, I think I've reached a point where I feel compelled to some degree to share some of those stories. And I've chosen to use the venue of fiction writing to get some of that out there. Kind of a catharsis, I think you would say, in terms of expressing that part of us that we all have. Some of us just are more willing to share it than others. And in my case, it's taken me quite a few years to get there.
Well, the cover of your book looks rather dark and sinister, as opposed to my last guest has a bright Victorian house. But your Victorian house is rather dark, and there are clouds in the background. And you don't say who did the illustration. And I was wondering, because in the book, they mention a lithograph, which I don't know if really exists or not.
Yes, it does.
So this illustration was based on the lithograph?
Actually, the lithograph that I was able to find in one original sketch as well are the only two examples I could find of what was truly in existence at the turn of the century in Vallejo, called the Good Templar's Orphanage. Beautiful building, but not quite the architecture that I was looking for. Beautiful in its own right, but I really couldn't find the quality of what I was looking for to become the cover of this book. So actually, I just did some research. I tried to find the scariest looking picture I could find of something that fit the bill of being at least three stories tall, as the Good Templar Orphanage in Vallejo was, and I chose that particular photograph. As you will see, there's also some gravestones that are in the forefront of that particular photograph, and this is also consistent with what we know about the orphanage in Vallejo, is that the grounds surrounding that building were used for burial. When orphan children died and there was no one to claim their bodies, the property was just used as an ad hoc cemetery, which was not unusual at 1910, 1950, 1920.
Well, there was this real orphanage, the Good Servant Orphanage.
Correct.
And your book, The Good Serpent Orphanage, is fictional, so it's fine if you have a fictional house on your cover, but it's nice that you try to be as authentic as you could.
As is always the case, I try to get as much fact into my novels as will fit the narrative that I'm trying to create. It's that odd mixture of that which is real and factual and that which the storyteller needs to have the creative license. To create characters that truly did not exist, to find dialogue and have those individuals expressing thoughts, feelings, or emotions. So as my first two novels, the same with the third one here, it's a blend, and I try to do my readers the service by having that section at the end of the book, once the story is told, called author's notes. And in that section, as I've done with my previous two novels, I go back through the story and highlight pieces of the narrative that were true or factual, and or I will also tell my reading audience, here's a piece of factual history. I chose to either twist it or bend it a little bit because I couldn't quite fit the narrative the way I wanted. So I may have moved things up and down the timeline of history by 10, 15, or 20 years to get the right character into the story.
Well, I really appreciate that because it sometimes drives me a little nuts to be reading a historical novel. Okay, which is fact and which is fiction?
Right.
And so you answer that question for us And I'll have to tell you, that's the order I read the book. I flipped right to those facts in the back of the book and read them, and they were so fascinating. You have so much interesting information that we know is true because we've heard of the Zodiac Killer, for example. And you make connections that we thought, oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a compelling criminal who to this day has never been revealed, despite all the effort and time that's been spent investigating who the Zodiac Killer was, if we can speak of him in the past tense. And I think most surely we can by this point in time. He's certainly way too aged to still be with us. It's never been solved. People don't know who he was. One of the key individuals who a number of police departments had fingered thought for sure this was the guy. They just couldn't pin it on him. As the years have progressed with technology and DNA, even just recently, some of the envelopes that that individual used and some of the stamps that he would have licked in sealed envelopes when he was mailing these taunting letters to the Vallejo PD or San Francisco PD, some of those police departments thought, here we go. We've got it. We'll just swab this and we'll extract DNA off of that. We'll find out if this matches who we've always thought for years was the Zodiac Killer. And they did find DNA on the back of those envelopes that had been licked. In the back of those stamps, it did not match any known suspect in the Zodiac killing cases.
So back at square one.
There you go.
Well, how did you relate the Zodiac Killer to your story?
Well, I wanted to wrap that character somewhere into the narrative. And because he had committed so many of his crimes in the Vallejo area, and because it was set, the setting for this novel is Vallejo, and not only Vallejo, but an orphanage that truly did exist there at the turn of the century. And what we know factually from history had a number of evil, some really evil things that occurred there that eventually led to its demise. I thought, why not find a way to grab that character, who no one knows to this day, and somehow insert him into the story? So that's what I did. Again, I had to bend time, so I think that there's no way, truly, that the Zodiac Killer could have been one of the orphans. Otherwise, he'd have been way into his 60s or 70s when his crime spree started. But
there could have been people like him.
It's possible.
That were raised in this orphanage.
It's possible. We do know that child maltreatment often expresses itself in a number of ugly ways when these children who society has not taken care of or ultimately become adults and are unleashed. That's a fact we know from child maltreatment and child welfare.
My guest is David Alley, and he has written an historical novel, The Good Serpent Orphanage. And I would like to kind of do this as a flashback. Rather than start back when the house was built and when it got started as an orphanage, I'd like to go to a part in your book where you have a conversation between a loan officer at the bank and a young realtor. And the reason I want to go there is that I thought, David, this probably has come up. Somebody's probably said these words to you. You have a loan officer talking to this young lady, and he says, I wouldn't have ever thought a smart, college-educated woman like you actually believes in all that nonsense. And David, here's this smart, college-educated man like you, and you actually believe in all this nonsense?
Well, again, I love telling fictional stories. But I think what's bleeding through some of that stories, or all of my stories, is actually some very uncomfortable facets of time and space that we live in that I've reached the point in life where I no longer feel comfortable denying them. I can't explain them, although I'd love to scientifically be able to do that. But I'm convinced that they do exist. And how I can correlate or bring those two things together, I cannot. So it sounds somewhat schizophrenic to say I'm a scientific person, which I am. I'm a professional person, which I am. And I have all this formal training, which I do. And yet here's this other side of me that says certainly some of these things, not all of them, but some of these things do exist. And I believe the parties who share this information with me, for the most part, of course, we should always scrutinize them. I myself am the best at doing that. I do not take instantly what someone tells me. I always subject it to a number of scientific criteria. But when every other explanation has been exhausted and I'm looking at someone or sharing with someone who's telling me their story, I think perhaps there's a part of us has to say, well, maybe that is possible.
Well, you also have this loan officer say to this young woman, realtor, you seriously won't try and make the case that that old Vista Viejo neighborhood is haunted, will you? David, you're seriously not going to make the case that this place is haunted, are you?
What I would like for my readers to do is to draw their own conclusion. Again, it's a work of fiction, and so as such, it's simply meant to entertain. But if there are threads of truth that readers feel stirred as they're reading through this novel, by all means, that's up to them. And I've long ago come to grips with the fact that there's a part of this existence that you and I live in that's simply not explainable. Science, for all of its robustness and the technology that we have advanced to in this current day and age, I appreciate, I love, it cannot answer every single thing that we as human beings experience. It can answer a lot of it, but it just can't answer every single piece of it.
My guest is David Alley, and this is his third historical novel. The title of it is The Good Serpent Orphanage, and an orphanage called the Good Servant Orphanage actually existed in Vallejo, California. And I would like to go to the section of your book where you give the facts about the Good Servant Orphanage of Vallejo. And this is in the back of your book. You say that it did exist in its nearly 50-year history. And that's a pretty long history.
Yes. And what we know from the research that I've conducted is that, as with all benevolent institutions, it started out with great fanfare. It started out with the best of intentions. But as time progresses, I think it's the natural state of things to deteriorate. And if people don't pay attention or are on the watch, it's very easy for evil to begin to corrupt and manifest itself. We could draw parallels between something like this, for example, in politics. The longer we have people in positions of power who don't turn over, the longer they stay in that power, it's very easy for people to get corrupted. And I think that is what happened with an institution such as this.
Because it started out, you say that it was in once rural area, and that it admitted more than 4,500 boys and girls. And there's where you were just mentioned, is that until scandals involving allegations of murder and sexual abuse closed its doors in 1919.
Correct. Again, many of these young people who were admitted to that orphanage at that time are what are on the record books as known as half orphans, which is another heartbreaking piece of this narrative. Today, it would be hard for you and I to imagine that existence of a parent admitting a child to an orphan and to an orphanage and walking away, given the state of foster care, good or bad as it is, the troubles as it has. But back then, over half of the records indicate that over half of the children were what they call half orphans. They had a living mother or a living father. But for whatever reasons, that adult simply committed that young child or children to that institution and then ostensibly walked away. And we tend to judge folks from history through the lens of our own current values and experiences. And I've tried hard not to do that in this case. And yet, here's how many children passed through that orphanage. Many of them still with a parent out there somewhere who simply abandoned them and let them go.
Yeah, and you tell us a heartbreaking story of this father who takes his son to this orphanage.
Correct. And this is one example, a very difficult piece for me to write. And yet, I think that it's probably atypical of the scenario back then where an intact family suddenly is without the other spouse and left in a situation like that in a new area where they're not from, where they don't know anybody. I can see a man, I can't honor it, I can't recognize it, I'd never do that, but I can see a man leaving a young boy at a place like that thinking, you know, I can't care for you. I don't have the ability to do it. I don't have the wages or the income. Here's a place where we're told is a good, solid institution that'll teach you hard work, that has academic studies, that can feed you 3 square meals a day and take care of you. And in fact, that's the narrative that I put in this particular novel.
And we hear that a lot of times with adopted children, that the child maybe is resentful until he finds out, no, the parent really, or parents, really did love the child. It's just that they felt that it was in the best interest of the child. And that's the impression we get in your story, that this young boy, Luther, is taken to the orphanage because his, not because his father doesn't love him.
Correct. Love is not on the table. It's a matter of, in this particular story, a young boy who suffers from a physical malady. Obviously, it's woven in the narrative that his face is horribly disfigured. I really don't go into explaining how he came to be that way. I kind of leave that up to my readers to fill in the blanks.
But, yeah, because I kept reading thinking, oh, he'll tell us what happened to this boy.
I never did. and I deliberately left it that way so that my readers can fill in the blanks. One of the key strategies that I enjoy when I write and put something on paper is to leave enough room for whoever's reading to interpret it or apply their own history or background to what's happening. And thus, in that way, you can come up with thousands of different narratives. No two readers may, in fact, interpret it the exact same way. And that's a deliberate strategy on my part, when and where possible. You can't leave too many holes or too many blanks in it, or the story's not compelling and it doesn't move along. But if you can leave just enough mystery there for readers to fill in, I think that's one of my preferred approaches, actually.
Well, out of that many thousands of boys and girls, I'm sure there was a story that was very similar to what – there must have been a story very similar to the one that you have told, that you've made a fictional story. And the young boy, you've got a scene where he's talking to his dog that's just heartbreaking. Because the dog doesn't care if the kid has a deformed face.
No, animals don't. they love us and accept us for who we are. And I think that's it's unfortunate that we as humans don't seem to be able to follow the same suit. We're so judgmental, I think, particularly from a physical perspective. And more so when you go back in time, it's easy to see where people who had physical maladies or physical deformities at the turn of the century were considered either cursed by God or forsaken by God or receiving some type of karmic punishment perhaps. And they just weren't given the same consideration we do today. We've made a lot of progress in this regards with folks who suffer from physical disabilities. We're still not there. I believe there's still some degree of discrimination. We're still a culture, and at least in America, that's very, very focused on physical appearance, physical looks. That's how we tend to judge one another so often. And in this particular case, here's a young boy who did nothing whatsoever to deserve the hatred, the prejudice that is assailed upon him, simply other than his face is not perfect.
Well, speaking of that, too, you put in your story, and you say that not necessarily, probably didn't, lobotomies were probably not performed there. But there's a case where we know the Kennedys. It wasn't that he didn't love his daughter. He thought he was acting in her best interest. But that the fact that lobotomy was performed until what, 1967?
Yeah. My research, including in the author's notes, makes reference to the science of lobotomies, as we now would call them. And I think most people would struggle with the word science. It's hard to imagine today that at one point in time in American medical practice, that was a widespread practice. It was done in America perhaps more than any other nation that I can discover performing lobotomies. And you reference JFK's sister, Jack Kennedy, who committed his daughter to this procedure.
You mean his father did?
Yeah, his father.
Joe Kennedy.
Yeah, Joe Kennedy committed his daughter to have a lobotomy and left her forever transformed in a negative way. We don't know why he did that. There's no indication that we have, but Kennedys famously are a very secret family, but we don't have any information in the public that tells us that she was wildly emotional or given to temper tantrums or fits. But there must have been something that led him to pursue that path.
Yeah, and you mentioned that that is a fictional part that you included lobotomies.
Correct.
At the orphanage.
There's no record of lobotomies ever being performed at the Good Templars Orphanage in Vallejo.
Well, I would like to get back to what this orphanage, the facts that you have concerning this orphanage. And you say it was 20 acres? It said the Order of Good Templars built the orphanage, buying 103 acres, donating 20 acres for the orphanage, and dividing the rest of them into smaller plots. And then what are the dates then that we have concerning this, the real orphanage, the Good Templars?
This is the historical fact of regarding that orphanage. On May 11th in 1869, the cornerstone was set, and October 1st, 1870, it was the opening day, accepting boys and girls 18 months to 16 years old. In the first year, it took in 106 children. Again, most of those were identified as being half orphans. So they still had a parent, a living parent, but nevertheless, they were given over to that institution. The nickname of it in its earlier stages was called the Great White Prayer on the Hill. And we have a number of historical references that I've found in my research that's the way they refer to this institution. So at one point, its original coding or color must have been white. I suspect by the end of its history, it was some other color than that. But that's what the locals...
That's in your imagination. It's quite
dark.
That's
what the locals called it. Yeah, yeah, correct.
So you say that electricity was installed in 1909?
Yes. Olive Wilson is the superintendent what's credited with being on site when the electricity was installed. And she was actually... in the history of the many superintendents that passed through that orphanage, and there were a number of them, and records are not extant which tell us every single one of them, and you and I can draw perhaps some reasons why that may be the case, but she was the one of them that does stand out. Her history there and her time there is replete with the number of good things she did, including the installation of electricity when many of the homes in Vallejo at that time still were without it.
Would you also say that... children were admitted to this theater to see popular movies. You said they were admitted free to this theater to see movies. Non-denominational Sunday school lessons were given Friday nights. Non-sectarian church services were conducted on Sunday. So they weren't trying to convert these children to any particular religion?
No, it appears to be one of the founding principles of the institution that it would not proselytize any one particular faith. Although they obviously practiced, you and I can deduce that it was a Christian faith at that time, but no particular denomination was favored one over the other. The Good Templars, by their very definition, the founding or fraternal organization that paid for this institution and were responsible for its upkeep in the earliest years, they were a non-sectarian group. I think the thing that bound them together as a fraternal organization was their stance against alcohol. So yes, they were instrumental during the era of bringing Prohibition to come to pass. So we know that that's what they stood for. But beyond being fans of Prohibition, there evidently was room for members of the Good Templar organization to believe a number of different denominations.
Well, one thing that surprised me, you said its busiest year was 1893, 211 children enrolled there at the home. And the records indicate that the many different staff who served there over time came from 30 different states in the United States, including states as far away as New York, and in addition, 15 countries. And you name all these countries that the children and the staff came from, like Turkey and England, Germany, Scotland, Japan, Ireland, Armenia, Denmark, Portugal, Switzerland, Canada, Sweden, France, Italy, and Russia.
Yeah.
All these people are coming to this orphanage here in California.
Yes. And my suspicion is that is due to the fraternal organization of the Good Templars. As those chapters began to pop up worldwide against Prohibition, and the Good Templars were not, I would say they were to some degree modeled after a Masonic order, though not fully so. Those chapters popped up. I'm sure that this orphanage got the reputation as one of the places that if you were a Good Templar and you were seeking to leave your country of origin and come to America, why not serve at the Good Templar orphanage? So the records indicate that is, in fact, where many of the staff came from.
Well, when did the orphanage close?
Let's see. I believe I have it.
Yeah, you say it closed in 1919.
Right.
The real orphanage closed
in 1919. Yeah, the true orphanage closed in July of 1919. And it's due to several factors, but I think the thing that caught the public's attention the most were the scandals. The number of children being committed there declined. We don't know why that's the case, although having an institution that's ridden with scandal can lead to that very thing. So it's a self-perpetuating philosophy or prophecy, if you will. The more you hear ugly stories about something, the more people stay away. If your institution is founded upon patronage, then you have less patrons and you have less income, so you can't keep it up, and it just began to slowly deteriorate over time.
Well, if it got a reputation for evil things happening there, the subsequent use of the property was unfortunate. There are all sorts of bankruptcies. Everything that tried to move in there would go bankrupt or some would some misfortune would befall it?
Yeah, a number of ventures followed, none of which seems to have been successful over time. Initially, some of them may have enjoyed a small degree of success, but they didn't stay, and eventually they went bankrupt. I think the first thing to come in behind it in 1923 was a golf and country club. The property, unlike my fictional narrative in which the orphanage is burned to the ground, that is not true. That's my
creative. The fire is your imagination.
Yes, it's my creative license in the narrative. But the property was deconstructed, so a bulldozer came through and leveled everything to the ground. And then a golf club came through. It did not make it. Then an orchard was planted, and that did not make it. And then ultimately it was turned over to a housing subdivision. And in the earliest stages, that subdivision went through a number of iterations and bankruptcies.
Well, that's one reason you conclude. Your concluding fact is the property on which the Good Serpent Orphanage of Vallejo once sat is haunted. And it does say Good Serpent, but I think you mean Good Servant Orphanage. You say it is haunted because everything failed or came to ruin. Now, before I say goodbye, and I want to remind listeners, that your novel is The Good Serpent Orphanage, but you are now currently working on a nonfiction, a fourth book, which will be nonfiction this time, called Paranormal Nine. And it has nine short stories, vignettes of true firsthand experiences that you yourself has had with the paranormal.
That's correct.
You're putting yourself out there, Dave. Yeah, we will look forward to reading what you have to say about that.
It's a leap of courage on my part to put it out there. But I've made the determination that I'm going to do it. There's more than nine, but I've just determined that those nine, I think, make the best reading. So that's currently what I have in draft form. In this particular book that I'm going to publish, I've also created a one-page ink sketch or a short vignette to match each of the opening stories. So as amateurish as the art may be, nonetheless, it is the author's artwork. So I put one of those panels, original ink sketches or panels, preceding every chapter of those nine chapters.
So you're the author and illustrator of
Paranormal Nine.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Mark Morlock, author of The Secret Watcher of Summit Avenue. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.